live. So, welcome to your very first podcast.
Thank you, sir.
Do you think that the energy changes now that you know we're officially live?
A little bit.
Yeah.
But in a good way.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. In a good way. It's stage time. I remember whenever we were setting up the microphones, the first time I brought them back from Oklahoma, and it took me so long to try and figure out even how it worked. But once I finally figured out the audio, I had been around the equipment for like 4 hours by then. But once I hit record, I was like, oh my gosh, even though I had been around the audio equipment so long. So I still get that. And I see like the big podcasters who have been doing, like Joe Rogan just dropped his 1800th episode.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. So I think of 1800 different times where he's clicked record. And he's probably done more than that that didn't get released.
Sure.
And I'm like, I'm curious if he still gets nervous, you know?
Yeah. That anticipatory
anxiety. Because the beauty of the human interaction is that it's unpredictable.
Totally.
Right. And you can probably empathize with that, right? Like, that's where we get that anxiety of not knowing exactly what's going to happen.
Totally.
But this is your first podcast. So now you get to check it off the list.
Absolutely.
And you can say, well, never doing that again.
What a better way to kick it off than with my brother-in-law, you know? Truly. Not everybody gets that opportunity. So
when was the first time you heard me talking about a podcast?
Oh my gosh. Probably, I want to say maybe 9 months ago. I feel like you've been talking about it for a long time, 9 months to a year. Yeah. You'd mentioned it kind of slowly throughout time. And then I felt like you were speaking about it in more of a serious way, probably around that time, from what I remember. However, it could be further back than that. But
Yeah. So 9 to 12 months. And then what's your history of podcasts? Do you listen to podcasts?
I love listening to podcasts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what's your favorite podcast?
I don't know if I necessarily have a favorite. I like a lot of different types of podcasts. I like listening to comedians a lot. But lately, I've been listening to a BBC podcast called In Our Time. Uh-huh. So essentially, it breaks down different philosophers, ideologies, and things like that. So that's been really interesting to listen to, especially kind of getting different people's perspectives on one thing.
Yeah.
Trying to enrich my brain health, you know, right. Brain camp.
And that's a lot different than the comedians because you're listening to like Sebastian Maniscalco.
Totally. Mindless in right. A good way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But now you are listening to Augustus.
Yeah. History podcasts as well. Been really deep into the ancient Roman history, ancient Egyptian, that overlap.
So Augustus was the first, what, Roman emperor?
Well, that I don't know.
Yeah.
That I don't know. I'm more right now into Cleopatra and Mark Antony and kind of those relationships and Mark Antony's previous wives.
How many did he have?
He had three total, I think.
Okay.
So Fulvia, Octavia, and then Cleopatra, obviously.
Wow.
So.
And I've heard of Octavia too.
Yeah. And she, I believe Octavia is one that had her brother with Octavius and he was a bit of a troublemaker from what I've been hearing in these podcasts. So,
oh, boy.
Yeah. He was quite young, I think, when he came into leadership. I think he was like 19.
Wow.
As a consort or something. So
wow. So I was watching this video and it talked about artists. Mm-hmm. And one thing I didn't know is that back in the day, apparently it's not as much this case, but back in the day, a lot of these really big pieces of art, they were funded by like a patron. The artist had a creative vision, right? But even more so was the patron's creative vision and saying like, this is what I want. And they'd have a contract for it. And Augustus, whenever he was emperor, he had all of his like sculpture pieces make him look like he's in his 20s. Even though he's like 60, 70, you know, because it was like youth and the vigor. So it makes me think about that was happening back in the Greco-Roman era when they were making art, with the patrons having the artwork. So I'm thinking of all the brilliant artists who are like, ooh, I want to make this, but instead they made all these other things because that's where the money was.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like that was more commonplace then, and even still now, it carries through throughout history, I think. And it is interesting to see how that imagery of that idealistic, youthful representation of a leader really they wanted to instill in the people that were following them, like, this is who I am. This is who I will always be, that perpetuity, yeah. That presence of perpetuity, even though they're mortal beings, they're not immortal. They tried to portray themselves in that way. And that's really fascinating because especially sculpture, those types of things were in public.
Right.
So you're walking through the streets and you're seeing these things, you're being reminded that this is where you are and this is who you should be following, kind of a thing. So yeah, do find that interesting.
Yeah, I'm imagining, like, if that were the case now, like, imagine Donald Trump, but there's a sculpture of him and he's like 22. You know what I mean? And he's like jacked and it's in front of the White House.
It's like Photoshop before Photoshop existed.
Right, like the Instagram filter. Yeah. That's what Augustus was doing back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine showing up and you finally get to meet the emperor. And you've seen this 20-year-old ripped guy, you know, your whole life. And then you walk in there and it's this old man who's like scratching his back.
Like, am I being punked?
Yeah. It's really cool. But before you came on here, I watched a 30-minute video of art history.
Oh, wow. Did they zoom you through just everything?
Yeah. So I was trying to learn a little bit because I know that you studied art history for a little bit, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I was curious because you had like 6 or 7 different majors in undergrad.
Indeed.
Right?
Yeah.
So like, how did you actually end up with the final one?
Kind of by accident. From the jump, I was in journalism, and because of that program, you had to take a foreign language. Well, since I had already taken many years of Italian, I thought, I'm just going to continue with that because I'm not only interested in the language, but also the culture and just kind of learning more about the history of the development of that country. So I started taking Italian courses at KU. And through that course, I was introduced to an art history teacher who was teaching an Italian Renaissance art and architectural history class. And that's kind of where I came to find that it was a pairing of things that I really enjoy, history and visual art.
Nice.
And from there, I just continued taking those courses and yeah.
And then how'd you end up at SCAD?
We were coming from a road trip from the southern part of Florida back up to Wisconsin, and we drove through Atlanta. There is a SCAD campus in Atlanta, and my mom said, why don't you check it out? And at the time, I wasn't really quite sure what I was going to do with my career.
What was the senior year?
It was, yes, right before the end of my senior year. So I think it was fall time. Yeah. And so I checked it out, and they had a really great art history program. And it just so happened that that program was in Savannah, Georgia. And that's also an incredibly historic place, as many people know, really rich in history. So I felt like it was a perfect place to be to study that.
Yeah.
And to be in a creative space as well. All the people that attend that school are there for a reason. So there's a lot of, you know, interaction between different disciplines.
Yeah, that's cool. It's like you want to be at a important place that you're studying, like meteorology in Oklahoma is big, right? Because
sure. Yeah.
The weather's so unpredictable there.
Yeah.
So you get to live there and be there. Yeah, this equipment, it's like noisy. You end up studying art history at SCAD. So you're going to grad school there.
Mm-hmm.
Was this a surprise to you that you were studying art history?
Yes. Yeah. I would not consider myself very academic in the sense that, you know, people who study art history are pumping out these articles and papers and stuff all the time.
Right.
I never really considered myself that. I really just have a passion for learning about people through the history of imagery. And that's what art history is. It's really learning about people in the way that they've been represented, and just learning different stories as well. So yeah, I did not expect to be doing that. And in the setting that I was in, Cascade is a very, you know, very well respected school. And I thought, oh gosh, there's just maybe a 10% chance that they take somebody like me, you know? So grateful that they did, because it was a very a time of growth and, yeah,
so challenge. What did little Mia want to be?
Oh, boy.
Other than Michael Jordan.
Right, yeah. I had a huge thing for Michael Jordan. My email address still has his 23 in it. You know, I felt like I always really liked to create things. Even my sister and I, Annie, you know, we would go in the basement and we would pretend like we worked in our dad's office, and we would create these little sheets. So just even things like that, I always really liked being in a creative space and really liked helping people as well. So I don't really know that I had a specific thing that I wanted to be. Some people have this idea, I want to be a doctor,
right,
or I want to be a nurse, I want to be a teacher. I don't really know that I ever had that moment as a kid.
Right. Yeah. Was there anything you didn't want to be?
Oh, yeah.
A lot of things, probably.
Yeah. It was like process of elimination, I feel like.
Right. That's how it's been with me. I remember whenever I was little, I always wanted to be a professional soccer player.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I love soccer.
That was it. I loved it so much. And as I got older, one of the things I thought about is from being a professional soccer player was I wanted to do like the post-game interviews, which is so weird. But no, like,
that's great.
Yeah. But like, that's whenever I also developed like an appreciation for talking and particularly with questions, right? Like answering questions. I love that idea of you don't know what's coming down the pipeline, you know, but here we go and let's answer it to the best of my ability. Whenever you were younger, you were the big sister, right? What's that like being the big sister?
I think it's incredibly unique that my sister and I are quite close in age. So in a way, it always kind of felt like we were twins, you know. Not only do we look alike, but we're so close in age. And also our brother, we're all very close. Someone asked me this question the other day about, you know, are you close with all your siblings? And I said, well, yeah. To me, that seems like such a natural thing. But I know that's not always the case. I think being the oldest, sometimes you feel like you need to protect your younger siblings, even if there's not necessarily anything to protect them from.
Right.
And also trying to be a really good leader as well and a role model. I think that those are things that have been on my mind since I was little, you know? And being a really good listener, I felt like when we were kids, you know, listening to my siblings was something that I really tried to do, you know, like when Annie told me to get her the scissors so she could cut her hair. Yeah. I was listening to what she said and I actually did what she said.
You completed the mission.
Totally. So I was an accomplice and all that. But, you know, those are things that I feel like as the oldest sibling.
Did you feel pressure?
Tons of pressure. If it wasn't external, it was definitely internal, meaning I put that pressure on myself because I felt a sense of responsibility to kind of pave a way, even though I, like, looking back, they took different paths. You know what I mean? It's not, right. I don't need to pave anything. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's funny that we get into that idea of paving the way.
Yeah.
Because I'm on the opposite end of the spectrum, right, as the baby.
Yeah.
But I think I still felt pressure of I was the last one, you know? So it's like, this is our last shot. Let's make sure it's a great one. And still running off of that pressure can be tough. When did you first get into your first like art class? And
oh gosh, when we went to Montessori school, I mean, for a time, and then, you know, we kind of bounced around a little bit school-wise. I vividly remember going to an art show where one of our friends at the time had some artwork on display. And there were all these young students that had stuff on display. And I thought, wow, this is so cool. People created these, they spent time making them, and they all look different.
Right.
And to me, I felt like, wow, there's no right or wrong answer. I felt like just kind of growing up, sometimes there was this pressure from, you know, external people, mm-hmm. In extended family, that there's a right and a wrong way to do something. And having that moment at a young age where it's like, wow, okay, there's not a right or wrong way to express yourself when it comes to art. There isn't. It's just you and the material, and you get to do with it what you want to do. And it's up to the viewer in a way to connect with it or not, or respect it or not. But you're creating something that expresses maybe an inner feeling or an inner thought outwardly. And so that was kind of my first experience in almost like a gallery type setting.
Yeah.
And I think that was really pivotal in me continuing to pursue that in different ways throughout my life from then onward. And even now, you know, I didn't necessarily actively know that I was pursuing that, but I was,
right?
If that makes sense.
Right. Yeah. It's a weird thing. I was just thinking about it because with art, whenever you're a little kid, mm-hmm. you do create, and with sports, mm-hmm. you show up and there's a defined metric of success, like score goals,
sure.
right?
Yeah.
Get on base, mm-hmm. or get the touchdown. But with art, it removes some of that. So that's interesting. I hadn't really thought about how, like you said, there's no wrong way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think that a lot of kids, how do they get better at art if there's no right or wrong way to do it? Like, what does that process of improvement look like? If it's not, you scored 5 goals this season and now you score 7 goals next season.
Mm-hmm. I think continued exposure to creative opportunities is really important. I think you're allowed to maybe refine certain skills. For example, you know, my good friend, Erica, she had been drawing for so long because she was continuously exposed to having those opportunities with a pen and paper to just continue to draw.
Yeah.
And now she does it as her job. Like, that's her profession. So I think it's important for them to have those opportunities. And I think that helps in that process. Uh-huh. Also in school. Yeah, that's great. But also doing things outside of school, because sometimes you just associate that then with, oh, I need to do this to get a grade, you know, kind of a thing. And we used to go to different classes, like at pottery, you know, ceramics places. We would do things there. And
you and your family would?
Yeah. Annie and I would in the summer sometimes. So it's great.
Your mom really made 2 artists out of you two.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And exposed you to like this love for creation. So what was one of the first things you created where you felt really proud of it?
There's so many things leading up to it that I'm like replaying in my head, like, oh gosh.
Yeah.
You know, and if leading up to that, I'll respond to that. But I had a teacher who she's an art historian. She's a professor at SCAD. And she said that her daughters bring home this artwork all the time. And she's like, I'm a lover of all things art, but some things just shouldn't be hung up.
Oh, man.
So she's like, I have this line that I've hung up in a room, and they can put whatever fits on the line.
Right.
And if they want something else up there, they have to take something down and throw it away. She's like, you know, and I think that's such a great way to kind of build character and also kind of say, everything you make is great, but let's keep this kind of stuff, you know, you select the things that should be on display, right? And I think that's also kind of building little curators and artists in that way as well. But I very vividly remember making this cat mask out of clay.
Uh-huh.
And I think my mom still had it up until
wow.
like this year, maybe last year when we were going through all this stuff and they moved. And I looked at it before I threw it out and I thought, wow, this was, you know, pretty good for someone who was, you know, young making it. It was black cat. I must have had a thing for black cats at the time. But yeah, I remember looking at it more recently and thinking, wow, that was a lot better than I remember it being, you know?
Do you think the black cat symbolized bad luck or misfortune?
Oh gosh, I really don't.
Do you think little Mimi was thinking about that?
Yeah, some dark arts going on up right. there. Yeah.
Like, what does this mean? What's the symbol of this art?
Yeah.
What was one of the biggest art failures you've had so far? I know there's a lot of small ones.
Oh gosh. I think in terms of my own creation, mm-hmm. watercolor paints are hard.
Aren't those unforgiving?
Yes. Okay. They're difficult to correct. I think they're hard. It's hard for me to manipulate the colors in the way that I want them to lay on the page. So I would say there's been a lot of a lot of abandoned watercolor work.
Yeah.
From me. Yeah.
Yeah. I think about the jokes I make. Sometimes they don't land. Yeah. And someone asked me about that, and I said, "Well, every now and then you cook a bad meal.
Mm-hmm.
You know." And yeah. You have to be okay with that. And I think about totally. That line in the art historian's room of her daughter's work
mm-hmm.
and how that's also a good exercise to manage ego. Because
totally.
I'm thinking of all of the things that we create. If we just limit it to like, all right, I'm only showcasing five,
mm-hmm.
Like all the trophies you could win, but you can't have a big trophy room. Just pick the five that you love the most.
Mm-hmm.
Like that would be a really good way to manage ego.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an issue with the creator or the creative ego?
I think it definitely can be.
Yeah,
for sure. I think also depending on the monetary value attached with certain artists and their work, I think the ego can be inflated easily. But also there are people out there, there are artists and creators out there that do keep that in check as well. So I feel like it just, you know, there's a spectrum there.
Do you think it drives greatness sometimes?
Having a large inflated ego?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, thinking of Michael Jordan.
Sure. I think if you're confident in what you're doing, that's different than having a big ego.
Okay.
And I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. What do you think the difference is?
I think having confidence in what you're creating means you're connected to what you're creating and you believe in it in a way that you're like, I get to share this with other people. And I think having an ego is like, well, this is representing me rather than this is a creation for the sake of creation.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. This is the me.
Exactly. Me, yeah. Me. Yeah. You're like, take a look at me.
Right. The Jamie Tart.
I did this, you know, instead of, you know, enjoy this as you wish to enjoy it. Because sometimes artists or creators, they give kind of a description of the way they want you to interpret something or the representation that they're giving, which sometimes is really great. And then there are sometimes artists that don't give anything at all. And I think that's also kind of lends itself an opportunity for the viewer to connect with whatever painting, photograph, whatever they're seeing in a different way, because it's personal to you. So you get to see and feel how you want to feel about it, but I also get the other side of it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think that ever upsets artists is they create this beautiful landscape and maybe they put a wooden ladder there because mm-hmm. their father was a painter
mm-hmm.
and then it goes to a gallery and they're like, now this ladder is a critical commentary on the working class, you mm-hmm. know, and the interpretation is much different than the actual mm-hmm. like intention of the artist.
Yeah. And I think that's where their voice comes in. When their voice comes in that way, giving that description is really crucial. If they want people to notice certain things, I think there is a certain responsibility on the artist, but I also think it's a responsibility on the viewer too, to say, hey, you know, I'm looking at this photograph and I really want to know more about it or more about the artist, to kind of take that initiative and look into it further as well. I think there's a lot that needs to happen,
yeah.
you know, to appreciate that. So, yeah.
How would you define creativity?
Creativity or the creation of art or just...
We'll start with creativity.
I think that creativity is kind of expressing the inner feelings and thoughts outwardly, and also just kind of lowering any walls or inhibition that you might have, and really being vulnerable. I think being creative means you're being vulnerable in a certain way, and you get to share that with other people.
Yeah. So you're expressing yourself. And I've heard you talk about art with that same phrase. Talk about the importance of art.
Sure.
Talking about the importance of self-expression. So why do you think it's so important for self-expression?
Because I think a lot of times artists and creators are expressing things that are really common feelings and emotions. And I think there's such power in sharing that with other people, because you're like, wow, okay, I really don't feel alone in this, or I'm not the only one who's feeling this way. And I think that in a way builds community, which I know you're really passionate about as well. So I think having opportunities where artists are really saying, hey, I have this vision in my head of what I want this to look like. I'm going to create it. I'm going to share it. And I want people to feel connected to this piece or to a group of people that are viewing this piece as well. I think that's really important, and kind of uplifts people in a different way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How do you think people become creative?
I truly think everybody is an artist, and I think everybody is a creator in their own ways. Some people are really comfortable with putting themselves out there on these huge platforms and sharing their art in a public setting.
Right.
And some people are artists and they just will create art and they'll keep it in their notebook and it'll be there, you know? And it doesn't also have to be visual art. It can be the written word. It can be, you know, podcasts. It can be so many different things. I think we all have a sense of creativity within us. It's just a matter of exercising it and maybe opening it up more and more through that exposure.
Yeah. And what would one need to do to grow in creativity?
Just keep putting yourself out there.
Yeah, like practice.
Yeah, just like anything, just like in soccer. You would continue to work on a certain type of shot to be really good at that.
Yeah.
And I think that's why a lot of artists, you know, they focus on one thing, like painting. I want to be a really good painter. They refine, or they want to be really, really skilled at painting faces or hands, right? They practice that so much to the point where their paintings of hands look like a photograph of hands. They look so real. You know what I mean? So I think kind of practicing and just going for it, you know?
Yeah, it's so inspirational whenever you see great art. Mm-hmm. And to think that a person who had to take a break to go pee and then to eat and then to drink water, and then their dad probably may have been upset with them, or maybe they're in a bad relationship. Mm-hmm. And then they returned to the canvas, and after several iterations, they made this painting. Mm-hmm. And then you see it and you're like, oh my gosh, someone the same species as me made that. You know, it's really encouraging, to know that we can create like that. I know that whenever a few weeks ago we had gone to the Nelson Atkins Museum in Kansas City, and seeing all of those paintings, right? And walking in there and seeing the Picasso and the Caravaggio, which was my favorite, and the Monet, is like all of these big names.
Totally.
And you're thinking about how they dedicated so much time and effort to create these pieces. And it's like, well, what could I do that for? You know, like I may not be the best painter, but like for me right now, the Avenue is podcast. So it's like, okay, dedicate as much time and energy as you can to make it the best one, right? To make it the one that people get to see and be inspired by. Mm-hmm. You talk about creativity and practicing, how that expands creativity. I know that with soccer, whenever I was a little boy, I would watch this player, Cristiano Ronaldo, Portuguese. And I always wanted to be him, and so many other people wanted to be him, because he was handsome and he was a superstar and he had that confidence and that bravado. But the issue was his playing style. Like, I couldn't replicate, and I tried and I watched it so much, and he's very fast and electric and super shifty. And it was discouraging, right? Because I'd be playing with all these different people And then I'd see someone who could kind of replicate his style, and they'd be scoring the goals and attacking the ball. And it was a couple years later till I found this player, an Italian player, called Andrea Pirlo. And Andrea Pirlo was a world-class player, one of the best in the world, but his style was the exact opposite of Cristiano Ronaldo. So he was slower. And his whole thing was about managing the pace of the game. And people would give him the ball, and he would kind of look around and make the perfect pass. Mm-hmm. It was all about decision-making rather than like being fast and being overwhelming. And that was so encouraging to me because that was my natural playing style, right? Like I always had the coaches saying like, speed up, speed up, or the teammates getting on to me. But I saw this guy who had played for the four biggest clubs in Italy and done great at all of them. And he was slow. So I was like, oh, how cool. Mm-hmm. So I think about that for creators. And I'm imagining like a young creator, like seeing something and trying to replicate that, but it's just not them, mm-hmm. you know, and after a while being exposed to more and more stuff and finally finding that niche of finding something fulfilling to them. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you went down that process?
I would say that I'm definitely more comfortable being, you know, the person behind the computer writing the visual analysis of what I'm looking at rather than sharing my art with other people. I've not made that leap.
Do you want to?
I think eventually, yeah. It's also more about just building on my portfolio and taking time to do that. And I've not taken time to do that, which I need to.
If it were perfect in 5 years, what would your portfolio look like?
I would have a really clear direction for what I'm wanting to say about the world around me. And I think that artists are really careful in doing that. It's very well thought out for a reason, right? They have something to say and they're going to say it in this certain way. And so I think I'm kind of on this journey of figuring out what that really first introduction that I'm going to give myself is going to be. And I think that's the cool thing about creating content is that you get to choose when and how and where you want to share it right now. You know what I mean? Rather than creating something for a patron, let's say in the Renaissance period or something, you would have to share that when the patron wanted that to be shared.
Right.
And so I think the cool thing about creating art for art's sake is that you get to share it in the way that you want to.
Wow. What do you think is preventing you from building that master portfolio?
I think there's definitely, you know, some fears attached with that. You know, you really are putting yourself out there. You're putting your thoughts about the world out there. And sometimes that can be a little intimidating. You know, really trying to break down those barriers a little bit has been a challenge.
Yeah. How do you do that?
I mean, I don't know. I'm in the thick of it right now. So I couldn't even tell you. But I guess
the little step.
Yeah, little steps. And also just taking more time to dedicate to that. Because I do think if I was, you know, making time, which there is time, it's just a matter of carving that time out or not and prioritizing that aspect of my life, which I do miss because I feel like I used to do a lot of that stuff. I used to take photos and then edit them and kind of create these kind of mock exhibitions in album form.
Wow, really?
But none of those have ever really been printed or seen the light of day, kind of a thing. Yeah. So it's like right now I'm just enjoying them and I'm sitting on these things that could be shared with other people. And so I look at all these other artists and I'm like, man, I wish I could be like that. And I can and I will eventually. It's just maybe taking me a little bit longer to get there.
Yeah. What do you like to take pictures of?
I really like landscape photography. I think that the land of a certain place says a lot about the people there or the lifestyle in an area. So I think that tells a story in a different way. And I also really like taking pictures of people as well, not necessarily portraits in that sense. And I was just reading something the other day about portraiture and how, you know, maybe we might have this perceived definition of what that means, meaning it's a picture of somebody's face, but it could be so many other things. And I think that's such a great way of describing kind of the fluidity of just that one idea.
You know? Yeah. What were they saying it could be?
That, you know, it could be somebody's hands up close. I mean, think about all the lines in your hands. I feel like that's kind of a roadmap in a way. There's some symbolism there. You can also kind of maybe tell the type of work that someone's doing. If they're working outside a lot, they're working with their hands, there's going to be some texture to that that might be different from someone who's working in computers and on the computer all day. So I think there's, you know, they were discussing that there's stories to be told by just fragments of the human body, right? And also fragments of a place as well. Telling the story, you know, maybe you're taking a photograph of the wheat fields in Kansas. That's telling the story about, you know, where you are geographically, but also maybe the labor that's being put into taking care of that. And then thinking about where that wheat goes after it's harvested, right? How that's helping other people. So yeah.
Who have been important artists in your life?
Oh gosh, there's just so many that I think, you know, anytime I see their images, their paintings or representations, they make you emotional in a good way. You know, you're just kind of, I feel like you're opening yourself up in a way just by looking at something. I mean, that's so powerful and you're sharing a space with it. I think there's something to be said about physically going to a space and experiencing art in the place that it's displayed.
Right.
That adds another layer of just, you know, that emotion to it. But I would say there's one particular artist that I love. His name is Pier Giorgio Branzi, and he is a photographer in Italy. He's just incredible. And I found him on a fluke. I tracked down his contact information by tracing his exhibitions in Italy to this gallery in Milan. And I reached out to them and explained, hey, I'm a student at SCAD. I'm in this history of photography class. And we have this project where you can choose any landscape photographer, essentially, or any photographer, and write this paper. And so I saw one of his images and I was like, dang, okay, I got to figure out if he's still alive because he's in his late 90s. And also, you know, how can I find out more about him? Because there's very minimal information about him online, especially from more academic resources, right? So there's certain websites you could go to and find stuff about him. But I really wanted to know more about him and how he got started in this. And just there were just so many questions swirling around in my mind. So I approached this gallery in Milan and they said, yeah, hey, you know, we've actually reached out to him. He just did an exhibition here not long ago. Here's his email address. So I'm reading this message and I'm like, what in the world? So yeah, I was thrilled in the least. And I eventually went to go meet him and interviewed him. All in Italian because he does not speak any English. So that was a very unique experience in its own right. Yeah.
What was it about his work that spoke to you?
I think the way that he used especially black and white photography to kind of capture the varying emotions after World War II in Italy. There's kind of, and even still people discuss this and debate this, this north-south divide in Italy, right? People from the north are really refined and well-educated. And, you know, you think about metropolitan cities like Milan, for example. It's this hub of, there's banks, there's fashion, there's just all of these really, really refined things. And then a lot of times people perceive the south as, you know, analfabeto, which means like they were illiterate, right? And I just saw something the other day too about how there was, I don't know his name, but somebody took it upon himself to kind of create these mini courses for people in southern Italy around that time, maybe a bit later, to learn how to read and write, because a lot of them didn't have the schooling opportunities that other people would have because they worked, you know, on farms. They did all this physical labor and stuff. So I just found that the fact that he traveled from, you know, Florence or wherever he was living at the time, south, and he did this trip on his motorbike, right? And met all these people and spent time with them.
In South Italy?
Yeah, and photographed them in a really respectful way that kind of said, the South is so much more than you perceive it to be. And I thought that was really kind of a brave thing to do at the time, because there was that kind of division, even after something so traumatic as World War II, you know, there were such fractures in societies all over Europe and all over the world, obviously. So I thought it was kind of really moving that he was trying to really bring people together in through photography.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he humanized Southern Italy.
100%.
And contradicted this narrative that they were not as sophisticated or not as bright.
I think he amended that narrative really elegantly. And, you know, he's known for being a journalist. So I think he kind of had that practice of interacting with people, much like you are. You know what I mean? You practice that and then you kind of take that in a direction that maybe he didn't expect to take it in, because they're really artistic representations, not as much journalistic representations, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And what would it look like if it was more journalistic? You think more like pieces and like...
Yeah, I think, you know, typically you're writing an article, you're getting a story to produce, to put on this platform to talk about something in society.
Why the South sucks.
Right. And he's creating these images because he sees that these people are people and they have something to say about where they live. They're proud where they live, you know, and they're proud that they're still contributing to society. I mean, without the farms and agrarian regions in Italy, would they have the things that they have? Probably not. You know, it's hard to know that, but I think that he really kind of made a point to say that and to allow them to say that about themselves.
So how do you think he did that with photos?
How do you mean?
Like, I'm imagining all of that being spoken or written, mm-hmm. and that being quite difficult to amend a narrative, especially like a narrative being held with like superiority and sure. inferiority and people. And so what was it about the pictures that you think said all that?
I think he captured a variety of things, you know, from youth to seniors, and doing different things. Some of them, you know, were like smiling and happy. And there was almost this uplifting sense to all of his images, even if they were, you know, kind of maybe experiencing a hard time or doing really difficult physical labor as well. There was almost just, it's like, you know, they're doing all this work and they're happy people though. You know, and capturing the simplicity of the architecture as well, I think was really important to him. Lots of clean lines, really smooth surfaces and things like that, showing that, you know, they're not just living out in the open. They're advanced people, right?
Yeah.
It is a society. There are little towns and villages and people have built things. It's not, you know, they're not nomads just roaming around trying to figure it out. There's established places and people are working, you know?
Right. So, it's like in Horrible Bosses where he says, they're not tribesmen.
Yeah.
Right, it's a developed city.
Yes, yes. I think he also kind of expressed this idea that even if they're maybe not literate, they can't read or write, they are still so important and they are still a part of that country. You know, they're a part of what it means to be Italian. It's this unity, this sense of unity, which I think had been lost, right. You know, during the world wars. So
was there civil war between them, North and South Italy?
not a civil war. It's okay. Just more of a social thing,
right,
from my understanding. However, I could be totally wrong.
Hey,
so
join the club.
Yeah.
But you're probably a lot more right than wrong whenever it comes to this. Were you nervous whenever you were going to interview him?
I was so excited. I think I was less nervous and more excited. I also thought, oh gosh, okay, I gotta brush up on this Italian
stuff. Yeah, no kidding.
Because, you know, I was a little rusty, but luckily with this, you know, the program at SCAD, you also needed a foreign language. So I was keeping up with that. And a lot of the articles I had used for certain classes were also in Italian, because that was really my focus, was more Italian art. So reading those helped a lot with maybe learning more of the complex sentence structures and things like that. But I was really excited. I remember I went over there. It was around St. Patrick's Day, and I stopped in Dublin on St. Patrick's Day. That was my connecting flight.
Wow.
And so I got to Rome, and I was pumped. I could not believe this was happening. And I met my dad's cousin, Danilo, while I was there. And he said, oh, you know, we'll go to the seaside for a day. I'm like, sure, why not? I'm going to give this interview like a day, and I'm a little bit nervous, but I feel like that's the Italian way. You just, yeah, we're going to enjoy every minute of every day. Let's just go to the seaside. Sure.
What an awesome buffer for your nerves.
Totally. And obviously this was all in God's timing. And I think it was so crucial for me to have somebody like Danilo, because he is so carefree, goes with the flow, loves a good, you know,
bite meal.
Totally a foodie. And I think being around that relaxed attitude helped tremendously. And also, it was during that time when I got to meet his brother Tiziano, which, if I'd met him, I was so little, I didn't remember him. And that was a gift. And I also got to, you know, spend time with his dad and then Zia Maria, who we were driving through the village where my nonna's family's from. And that also, I think, helped put me in the spirit of, okay, this is also really, you know, an agrarian place. People farm here. They had farmland. So I got to kind of see that as well. And it's such a small town built into this little hillside. And so I think to be there was really inspiring and helped me kind of place myself maybe in some of these photographs that he had taken, right? I was kind of like blown away by the simplicity of life and how happy people were and still are, and just kind of soaked that in. So yeah, I think that helped set me up.
It seems like a lot better than a Zoom call.
Totally. Oh my gosh.
Can you imagine had you stayed in Savannah and just been like, hey, could you set up a link and sure, I'll ask you these questions?
It would have been an absolutely different experience. I don't think I would have gotten what I did out of it had it been a virtual thing. And I'm just really grateful that he was willing to meet with a nobody from Wisconsin, you know, to talk about photographs that he'd taken a while ago. And I think that says a lot about him as a person, you know, and he's also quite famous in Italy. They're like, oh, you know, my cousin or my dad's cousin Danilo was like, oh my gosh, we're going to his house, you know? And I'm like, well, yeah, I don't know. To me, it's just getting together with, you know, somebody who I really admire, but also I see him as a person first, because that, you know, that cultural thing, I don't really know him the way that people in Italy might know him.
Totally. What was the conversation like?
Well, it kicked off with, so I spent the day there with him, his wife, Danilo, and then one of my good friends, Anne Marie. She and I had met on our study abroad for KU, and she actually met me in Rome so we could go there for the day. And that was just wild. We're driving through Campania, which is not far outside of Rome, and we're driving through, you know, these hills and stuff, and we pull up to this gate, and I'm like, hubba hubba, okay, here we go, guys. You know, and I have my little camera bag and, you know, I've got these notes on, hey, one of these images you took looks like an Edward Weston photograph. Is that something you were trying to achieve or what's the connection there? So I had all these things that I had lined up to ask him about his own work because there was so little, you know, academic literature on that. And I thought, this is a really great opportunity. I mean, I'm writing my thesis about this man. So I've got to just soak in every single second, ask him all the questions. And so we walk in and his wife is just an absolute doll. He is the sweetest. I mean, they're just the sweetest pair. And they wanted to, you know, have a little aperitivo. So we had some champagne. She's like, oh, we just have something light. I mean, it was pretty much a 4-course meal.
Oh, wow.
So it was very much a leisurely afternoon. And we kind of sat and just got to know each other first, which was huge. I'm sitting in this chair like, oh my gosh. Uh-huh. Okay.
You're nervous.
Totally. But I think having that time to get to know them both helped a lot. And also having Danilo there, I mean, I would say I'm pretty advanced Italian. However, there are some things that are still just difficult for me to grasp. So having him there helped a lot with maybe some translation issues that might have occurred. And it was just great. We filmed in his little porch area, which is also his studio. He still creates paintings and photographs, and he's just awesome.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So what's one thing he said that you remember?
So he said, and I believe this is also in his book, to swim against the current. And I think there's so much in those few words that are really, it's really powerful. I mean, think about how strong currents can be, whether you're in a lake or an ocean, any body of water, right? People swim against currents for strength training. And I think, wow, swimming against a current, that's hard. That's a really difficult thing to do, right? But I think there's so much reward in doing that. I think you're changing the direction of something. You're changing the pace of something. You're sharpening yourself, but you're also maybe sharpening others in the process, and you're learning from others too. So I don't know, that stuck with me.
And he lived that out with the whole Northern and Southern Italy.
Yeah. And even traveling, you know, to places like Moscow and just kind of capturing cultures in different settings. I think that he wanted to kind of maybe change the current, meaning change the ways that people are represented. And I think he achieves that. So, yeah.
So he just passed away recently?
No.
No?
I, as far as I know, I haven't talked to him, unfortunately, in the recent months. So I'm assuming that he's alive and well. I really hope so.
I read online that he may have just passed away.
Oh, gosh. Are you serious?
Let's Google it real quick.
Don't do it. I don't know if I want to know. No, Google it.
Yeah. Let's just Google it. Because I read this and I was going to ask you about his legacy. You know, like, how do you think he'll be remembered? But before
Yeah, I haven't talked to him in a couple months, so this will be sad.
August 27th.
Well, no wonder I haven't heard from him in a couple months.
How did you talk with him mostly? Was it
via email?
Email?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Well, I'll tell you what. His legacy lives on.
He's 93 years old. And he was still creating whenever he was.
I mean, when I visited him 2.5 years ago.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So how do you think Pier Giorgio Branzi will be remembered?
I think he'll be remembered for so many different things. But I think the thing that I will remember him most by is his kindness. I mean, he did not have to be as kind as he was to me. Like I said, nobody from Wisconsin, you know, some Joe Schmo just trying to write a thesis paper. So his kindness more than anything. And from what it seems, that he was just kind in so many different settings when he was interacting with the people he photographed. I think that says a lot about him as well, kind of treating your subjects with that respect. He didn't treat them like, okay, I'm the photographer, you're the subject. He's like, I'm here to experience where you are and learn about you and also represent you in a photograph, if that's okay with you, kind of a thing. So I think he'll be remembered for that. I also think he'll be remembered for, you know, swimming against the current and encouraging other people to do the same. I think that's such a cool thing that he said to me in passing, right? You know, as I'm leaving, he's signing my book, and I'm super excited that he signed the books I brought that have his photographs in them. And he said that, and I believe it's in one of those books that he had written that too. So I think he'll be remembered for that. And also just kind of using photography as a tool to talk about social issues, or maybe kind of break down some social barriers. I think he'll be remembered for so many things, but those are just a few that come to mind.
I hadn't thought about photography in such detail. What do you think photography, if done well, can really do?
Oh gosh, there's a great debate about this. I was just listening to a podcast, the In Our Time podcast, and they talked about Walter Benjamin and essentially his theory about the work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction, which is photography in essence, right? Photography is a mechanical reproduction of something you're seeing or experiencing. Yeah. And his whole idea is that the aura is disrupted because it's a machine, right? So when you have your hand and a paintbrush and a canvas, there is a different aura to that than there is when you're photographing. So I think that photographs, though, can really, even though they're produced by machines, really it's the person behind the machine that's framing it in the way, in a certain way, and it makes you feel differently than you would, you know, if, let's say, you see a picture of the pyramids at Giza, right? You might feel differently if you just see a really small portion of that rather than seeing the big portion. You might feel differently seeing, you know, a doorknob of a place than seeing, you know, the full door. I don't know. I think it could go either way. But what I mean by that is it's really a human who's actively creating that frame for you to feel a certain way. And I think photography can emit that because it's a human behind the camera.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes me think of, this is a silly thought, could be sillier, but the cavemen writing on the walls of the cave with berries, and then someone walks up with a paintbrush, and they're like, get that technology out of here.
Yeah, like that's trash, come on.
Yeah, that disrupts the aura of the berries.
Yeah,
you know, like, yeah. We don't want to use the paintbrush, but that is a trend of art, not a trend, a movement of art, that digital art is so big, right? And it's growing more and more and more. But there's such brilliant pieces that can be made. And I'm curious, it makes me wonder, like you and I going to the Nelson Atkins and seeing the Van Gogh and the Picasso, I wonder what that's going to be like in 100 years with the advent and the popularization of like digital art. Is it just going to be, do they just print them out and put them on walls like we do now? Mm-hmm. Or is it just going to be like walls of LCD screens, right? Going in and out. What do you think that's going to look like in the future?
Oh gosh, I think there's so many different ways that people, you know, express visually. Even now, there's so much video art and art that's created from, you know, oh my goodness, I forget her name at the moment, but essentially she searches a word on like Instagram or Flickr or something, like sunsets, for example. This is one that she's done. And she'll take all of the pictures of sunsets and she will print them out and she'll make a huge collage of all the sunsets to show this sense of everybody sees the sunset, right? But there's this thing about sharing it through these media platforms or sharing it with other people digitally that we just can't get off of. You know, everybody's hooked on this. And even if you try not to be, you are in a way, you know? So I do think that, you know, having access to digital creative spaces is important because you're also allowed to kind of disperse your art in a different way, you know, maybe more widely. And some people might argue that that kind of takes away this special notion of, wow, this is the Mona Lisa, right? This is the one, the only. I'm going to travel all this way to go see the one and only. Some people might argue that it kind of takes away that element of it. But I think also our society is changing so much too.
Yeah.
And art is changing with it. And, you know, it's all fluid, you know.
How do you think art affects society?
I think interchangeably, I think they both affect each other. You know, I look at someone like Jean-Michel Basquiat. So he was a painter, kind of active in the 70s, maybe. And he was so focused on kind of expressing these dichotomies of like inner versus outer, poor versus wealth. Like he was really interested in that. And think about what was happening during that time too, of also of like Studio 54, kind of this New York essence of, you know, you have these really, really wealthy people in New York, but you also have these really, really poor people who are suffering. And so there's like these two extremes. And I think that there's so much to unpack with his paintings. And I think he was an incredible artist. So I think with that, that's a really good example of seeing the ways that what was happening in the place that he lived or the society in general, that art can express that, or it can also express your personal feelings about what's happening too. And I think also art can be created to maybe represent unity or division or, you know, different things that are happening in unique ways that maybe say, wow, whoa, that mural really made me think about, I need to be better with thinking about the environment or, you know, things like that.
Yeah. So that's how it would impact society.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was watching a video and it was talking about Egyptian art and how mm-hmm. style is really important whenever you're assessing art, because like different regions had their own styles.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, even though 100 years had passed, this Egyptian face mm-hmm. had very similar features to a piece of art that was made later.
Totally.
Because it was the same style, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Coptic Christianity got introduced to that region mm-hmm. and it completely changed the style.
Mm-hmm.
And it showed the result of an idea coming in, or like ideas or society changing
mm-hmm.
and how that impacted art. And it makes me think of like right now, if you're in Egypt, you can have access to Lawrence, Kansas mm-hmm. online.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder how that's going to affect style, and like, will there be regional style still, or will it grow to a place to where, since everything's on Instagram or Pinterest or Flickr,
mm-hmm.
That you start to see that unique style go by the wayside?
You know, hard to tell, honestly. I do think that there's lots of borrowing, you know, people feel inspired by certain things they see, even throughout history. I mean, you know, the Greeks had been, you know, creating these structures and things, and then the Romans also were. And I think there's lots of borrowing in that. You can see when you look at them, they're not the same, but, you know, you can tell that certain techniques were like, oh, wow, that works really well for them. Let me see what we can do with it here, kind of a thing. And I think the same goes for that. I don't necessarily know if like regional styles would ever totally dissipate, but I do think there's a lot of, you know, cross interaction. And I think that's a good thing because new things come out of that interaction, and having access to that information too.
Yeah.
Is important.
Right. It makes me think of like the best creatives are those who have been, and this isn't the case. Like, I'm not saying this is the objective definition for greatness, but it makes me think that a great creative is one who's been exposed to so many ideas
mm-hmm.
and then boom, mm-hmm. they create something out of it,
mm-hmm.
which makes me wonder about how there's really good kid, like prodigies,
mm-hmm.
Because they haven't really been exposed to that many ideas.
Mm-hmm.
but maybe they've just been exposed to a couple and they're really good at them.
Yeah. I also think, you know, the environment in which you live into is really important. If you're being encouraged to express yourself in different ways, or maybe just to seek out information, if you have questions, you know, hey, what did this look like for ancient Greeks, or how did they build the Acropolis, or things like that. I think, you know, if you're encouraged to seek out that information, or if you're actively, you know, interacting with that, I think that helps a lot. And also, you know, sometimes people are, you know, recognized on social media because they're putting themselves out on social media, and then they're like, wow, did you see this kid? He's painting just like Basquiat, or he's painting just like Jackson Pollock. And so I think that's another factor too. If people are saying, I'm going to actively share this online, it's going to be, you know, more discussed than something that isn't, because of the way that we live. We live on social media.
Yeah.
Whether you want to or
not. Do you think that's going to reduce creativity?
No, I don't think it would reduce. I think if anything, people are able to maybe connect. Let's say a painter connects with an architect through social media, and then this really great project comes out of it. I think it allows more for connection in a different way, and maybe creating things in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird because you and I have like such immediate access to creating things mm-hmm. nowadays. It's wild, right? Mm-hmm. Like before, more than ever, we can communicate to more people than ever technologically possible. But one of the side effects of that is that we see all of this creation. And like for me, I see all of the great podcasts.
Yeah.
Which is cool. Mm-hmm. I can watch Lex Friedman and
totally.
I can hear him and understand what he's doing, but that can kind of psych me out, right? And make me nervous and be like, oh man, I don't know if I can be on that level. And so it's a funny side effect is that we have better access than ever before, but another byproduct is we also have exposure to more and more and more. And sometimes it can be hard to go from consuming content to creating content.
Totally.
One of the things I've been wondering about while we're talking is, you know, history is a good help whenever we think of Michelangelo or when we think of Bronzy, like these incredible artists who their work has built a legacy. And with Bronzy, society was a certain way. And that societal sentiment impacted his art. And he made this art that, like you said, amended that narrative. Like he did that. Who do you think is an artist who's doing that now? Like as we speak, in modern day society, is creating art that is impacting?
Great question.
Yeah, I was wondering that.
I don't have an answer for that. I would say I'm not really in tune with a lot of contemporary artists.
Yeah.
So that's something I don't know.
Yeah.
But great question.
And it makes me think of like pop cultural significance.
Sure.
Like Kim Kardashian, right? Like you hear her and it's not exactly like she came she rose to prominence via fashion or via entertainment. Like there's a lot of different things, but she became a cultural icon.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if we ever mix that up with being a good artist or like being remembered from work.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think so. I mean, I think an artist that comes to mind who really discusses that in his images is Andy Warhol. He was obsessed with this idea of celebrity. I mean, he did pictures of Jackie O, just that the reproducibility of those images. He would do, you know, like four or the soup cans. You know, it's one of those things where, yeah, there's this idea we have of people being famous, but what are they really famous for? So yeah, I would say that Kim K probably falls under that as well.
Yeah, it's like Michelangelo, I saw this sculpture, Dawn and Dusk. Have you seen that before? Mm-hmm. With the Medici. It was like over a Medici tomb. And it was so cool. I was like, whoa, like I want to see some Michelangelo.
His statue of David.
Yeah.
Massive, huge. I mean, people travel all over the world to see it, obviously, for obvious reasons. I mean, it's one of those things. It's like, whoa.
That's who we need to go see next is Michelangelo. But I'm thinking, like, with the Michelangelo, it's like, okay, you go and see the pieces. But with celebrity, it gets to this point where, like, I don't know, almost anything they do, it's like people consume it as if it's art, like it's content, right? Like, mm-hmm. It's quite weird.
Yeah.
The way we associate wonder with celebrity. Mm-hmm. It's odd to me.
Yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm. What's your artistic future look like?
I'm just going with the flow.
Yeah.
you know? Yeah, just going with the flow. Who knows? No telling.
And what does it look like now?
Right now, it's pretty at a place of not growing.
But your work, I mean, you're so, you talked to me about being a little kid and how you like creating things and you like making people feel nice. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're doing now, right? Is you're, you disagree?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, I mean, yes.
Loud and clear, right? That was really clear of you. but you do that at work because you're creating things and there's people who are partaking in that and be it creative activities or creative displays or creative pieces of work, you know, mm-hmm. they get to be a part of that. And yeah. I think that matters a lot. But it almost seems like whenever we talk about creativity, you have something else in mind. And since you may not be partaking in that specific activity, mm-hmm. like you said, you're in a state of not growth. You're so funny. What? How'd you get so funny?
You know.
You did something. You did something to get you so funny. Yeah. Do you remember when we first met?
Yeah.
Where were you?
I came to Wake Forest.
Came to Wake Forest. Mm-hmm. Boom. What's the, for anyone listening, okay, and their sister's about to get married, mm-hmm. what's that process like of getting to know the brother-in-law?
I consider myself really blessed because you are just honestly incredible. And every time I talk about you, people are like, oh, that's your brother. And I'm like, well, yeah, that is my brother. I mean, and I know that's not always the case. So to feel like, man, we hit the jackpot with Chris, you know, I mean, we hit the jackpot, you know, so just having, you know, even having the opportunity when you showed me around Wake Forest, the first time I met you, that was honestly some of my first moments with you. And I was like, okay, I see why Annie's like, this is the dude, this is it for me. And so just, it's been so much fun to see you guys grow and to also grow my friendship with you because I do feel like we have a lot of similarities in certain ways. And it's just been fantastic to feel like, wow, my sister married this incredible man, but also I have gained an incredible friend and brother out of this as well. So yeah, just enjoying those moments together, one-on-one, bonding time. You know?
Like we went on a pretty long road trip together.
100%. You're a trooper.
Yeah.
Getting to listen to different podcasts together. Uh-huh. Talk about, you know, certain opinions on things.
Hot takes.
Yeah. A lot of hot takes.
Laugh together. Yeah. I hit the jackpot. If anybody hit the jackpot, it's like you hit the scratcher jackpot. I hit the Mega Millions. You know? Stop. Yeah. Like, Different levels to this, but
yeah,
it's funny because your relationship with Annie, you all like very unique. Obviously, the sister relationship, and you all have such a good relationship. But it's not something I'm replicating with Annie, and like my relationship with you is not something Annie's replicating with you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But there's similarities that like you're a comforter to Annie, and so am I, and like like that's why we get along well with Annie. You know what I mean? And like we bond over that. Like we have similarities too in a lot of those instances. But
yeah,
I'm so glad that, like I said, I won the Mega Millions. You won the scratchers.
How did you get so funny?
Yeah, well, it was a lot of study for me. You know? I studied a lot. I cooked a lot of bad meals, and I still cook a lot of bad meals.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah. Yeah, you've cooked a few. You've definitely cooked a few. I've been present for some. But here's the deal. It's just like the artwork, like your pasta that required a knife. At least you created it. You know, I'm the one scrolling Flickr. What? I haven't put my stuff out there. I guess every now and then I'll cook you a meal, but...
You make a sandwich that's out of this world.
Yeah, I make a good grilled sandwich. It's like the... I can take good portraits, yeah. But that's it, man. But yeah, I'm glad that, you know, we get to collaborate and in life. And be creative together, because creativity is super important, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And art's for everyone, and we need people to be more creative, express themselves.
Yeah.
Thank you for being here,
Mia. Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, thanks. I have so many more questions.
No.
But I figure you can just come back on. Because you were such a natural. Oh, this is one of my favorite yet.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. This is what he says all the time.
Yeah, I'm looking down at my script, right? This is one of my favorites.
Like reading off the screen.
Yeah, but we have an hour and 20 minutes.
Okay, we're going to have to shave some of that off. Don't you think? Some of that's going to be an edit. That's an edit.
The middle 40 minutes I've gotten out. That's whenever we started to lose you. No. We're keeping it all. Okay, everybody, we will see you next time.
All right. Ciao, ciao.